Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Allahumma salli wa sallim wa barik ala nabiyyina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Allahumma la sahla illa ma ja'altahu sahla wa anta tajalul hazna idha shi'ta sahla. Allahumma a'inna ala dhikrika wa shukrika wa husna ibadatik ya rabbil kareem. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. All right, folks, so let's jump straight in to today's lesson. I don't actually know where we got to, because I think that last week we started obviously speaking about clothing and the like, right? And then that was last week, yeah? Where we spoke about subjective understandings of whether it's good or bad and that, okay, all right. So anything I say now in public is all like one blur. I have no idea who, what, what's going on. I don't think I've ever spoken this much in my entire life. Every night is like some webinar or a Maghrib webinar or Maghrib yani Q&A or LP. Dreaming, hallucinating, it's all just one merged reality. It happened. That's true. Whatever you claim that I've said, there's no defense. I like, yeah, probably. I don't know what to say. So he's absolutely right. And that's what he does all the time. Abuse me like this. Right. Listen, the thing is that you guys are not working together. Right. So in the Arabic then, what we're going to cover today, وَأَقَلَّ السُّنَّةِ بَعْدَ الْجُمْعَةِ رَكَعَتَانِ وَأَكْثَرُهَا سِتٌ وَيُسَنُّ أَنْ يَغْتَسِلْ وَتَقَدَّمْ وَيَتَنَظَّفْ وَيَتَطَيَّبَ وَيَلْبَسَ أَحْسَنَ ثِيَابِهِ وَيُبَكِّرَ إِلَيْهَا مَاشِيًا وَيَدْنُوَ مِنَ الْإِمَامِ وَيَقْرَأْ سُوتَ الْكَافِ يَوْمِهَا. It feels like we've been on this section for like last 3 months, I think. Right? It's like, it goes to show, you know, like some lines, it's only like two lines. But we've been milking that like, yani, mashallah. So, the minimum sunnah units after the Friday prayer are two, with six being the maximum. We've done that. It is the sunnah to take a bath, as explained previously. We've done that. And then to cleanse and perfume oneself. We did that a couple of weeks ago. And then last week, to wear one's best clothes, to walk early, so meaning to the masjid, to be as close to the imam as possible, to recite Surah Al-Kahf during the day itself, and to increase in supplications as well as sending salutations upon the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. We won't do the last part, but we'll do the thing here. So let's finish off the clothes section by being a bit more disciplined. And salams to everybody online. That's Sid, and that's Nabila, and that's Sarah Shams in London, Sophia and Balu in London, the twins in London, Auntie Shakila from the States, mashallah, Masood and Amina and Amal from Sheffield, and then we've got Maryam in Calgary, and then Suraya Baji and Doc, and just mashallah everybody. So welcome to all you folks. Right, so let's have a look. Where did we get to? I want to say that if we are going to be disciplined, then we probably start with what the Sheikh said. So we spoke about being that that it's good to wear the white. That some of the commentators to Zad al-Mustaqni', they said that the best of the clothes is white, and that he should put the imamah on, and he should put the rida on. The rida being a top cloak, top sheet, top shawl, top sari, whatever you want to call that top part of clothing. وَيَعْتَمُّ, this Arabic وَيَعْتَمُّ means to wear the imamah. I think I mentioned that, yeah? And their imamah is that which is wrapped around the head and it is tightened. And this is what the Prophet ﷺ used to wear and used to make the masah over it. But this was, وَلَكِنْ هَلْ لِبَاسُ وَإِيَّهَا كَانَتَ. But was his wearing of this imamah a religious thing? Or was it something entirely based upon the customs of the people? And we said, no, it was the custom of the people. I don't know whether I said this, but and it is the sunnah, Sheikh says, Sheikh Uthaymeen alayhi rahmatullah. وَاتِّبَاعُ الْعُرْفِ فِي اللِّبَاسِ هُوَ السُنَّةِ مَا لَمْ يَكُنْ حَرَامًا. So to copy the people in their customary clothing is a sunnah, an intrinsic sunnah, as long as it in itself intrinsically is not haram, right? Now, obvious, like, let's just take two examples. One extreme one comes, imagine you're living on the West Coast in California, where it's all surfing and, you know, bikini and blah-de-blah, right? So that's, if it's obviously, you know, 30 degrees every day, buzzing sunshine, then that makes sense that, you know, you wouldn't, and it's such a liberal culture, right? They don't care about nakedness and stuff. So then a woman should be then wearing bikinis and shirts and skirts and all the rest of it, because it would be sunnah to copy the clothes of the people. But obviously it's intrinsically haram, and so this is therefore whatever. So this is an important principle when you have a default which has exceptions. So the default is to copy the people except haram. That's an obvious one. A less obvious one is this whole debate about suits and ties. Right? Well, not suits, but ties. And since young, I was always told, you know, that the wearing a tie is a sign of a cross and all this kind of stuff. And it was initiated in the West as a sign of a crucifix, and Western culture is built upon it. I was bamboozled by this. I was like, they couldn't have thought of a different way, yani, of showing the cross than to wear a flipping tie? Huh? Well, there you go, another one there. That's another contribution to the conspiracy theory. It's a sign of a noose. Who are we hanging here now? Okay. Then I heard that someone said that, no, actually, yani, which is really putting a cat amongst the pigeons, that actually the kufs, they nicked it from the Ottomans, us. And that the tie is actually an Uthmani clothing or whatever. And if you type that into Google, you'll go down one yani rabbit hole that you're not gonna find the end of. You got all kinds of theories in there, like who actually owns the tie. Now here's the thing, if we are gonna sit here and debate whose actual clothing is it, that would give you a pretty good indication that the Islamic ruling has been lifted from it in terms of halal haram. Does that make sense? Right? I was having this discussion at home the other day. Not bow tie, Suraya. I'm talking about the normal tie. Although, what's the difference? Yani, you know, why would a normal tie look any more? No, because it. No, I mean, why would a bow tie not be a crucifix and the other one would be? Because it doesn't have the bottom part, right? Okay, yeah. But then, where's the side part of the crucifix then on the? Going around the neck. Oh, a bow tie doesn't go around the neck. It clips. Oh, you do the legit ones, the one that, not the ones that Shazad Salim wears. Yeah, the one that he buys from Harrods all the time. That's something else. Obviously, Shazad Salim's got levels. We're basic guys. We like clip on, you know, buy from. I've got no doubt about it, bro. You were born up with a double Windsor knot. In actual fact, your tongue is a double Windsor knot. I don't know about it. I just get the £2 on of Temu or whatever it's called, clip on and that's it. But the truth is that now I'm starting feeling a bit conscious about this one now. Stop me in the masjid. They were like, what the hell is the guy got a crucifix on his neck? But on a serious note, that's actually an important point because today clothing is everything now. You know, I got lots of nice Puma, yeah, and stuff. People now don't allow me to wear the Puma tracksuits anymore. They said they're haram, boycotted this, that, whatever. I go, what the hell is going to happen if I wear one that I paid for 10 years ago when they weren't even there? But now it's haram to wear that. Shut up. Yeah? And then you've got, obviously, the bow tie, ties and all that nonsense. Nike is a very good one. Yeah? It's the god of something. See, everyone's looking at what? Who? See? Shaz is like having a heart attack. Shaz, your entire wardrobe is haram, by the way. The guy's got so much Nike clothes, right? Anpar guy calls it Nike as well. Yeah? Nike for him. But for those who know, Nike. Are we Adidas or are we Adidas, boys? Who's Adidas? Astaghfirullah. You're such a bunch of Guyana coconuts, honestly. It's not Adidas, it's Adidas, okay, number one. It's Nike, not Nike. Although what would be interesting is to actually work out what the original word Nike, how it was pronounced when it was referred to in pagan terms. But apparently it's a Roman god of something or whatever. I don't know. So, Suraya Baji, I am the biggest kid on this planet. She goes, the clip-ons are for kids. And surprise, surprise. So, I don't know whether, I'm sure we must have had this discussion in LP, must have, about the concept of what has religious meaning, and yeah, I know that we've, I don't know how long to, yeah? The crucifix? About whether breaking the crucifix has a meaning or not, and whether you can pray in the presence. Yeah, we covered that in LP, yeah? All right, so we don't need to go down that. So obviously, if it's been such a long time, and people can't work out what's going on, and if you even ask the Kufs or the Christians or whatever, and they can't even see, or you ask the pagan, you know, druids or whatever, you know, and Stonehenge, who are all there, Nanga, and you ask them, and they say, we never knew that Nike was one of ours. Yeah, then what are we getting Anika's in a twist over, you know, when it comes to Nike? Just wear it, no problem. You understand the point, right? If there's not a connection, then I don't think that we need to kill ourselves over it. And then I guess it goes back down to then intrinsic harams. And intrinsic harams would be color, right? And intrinsic haram would be tightness or lack of covering. That's basically then what something would be intrinsically a haram. Or the obvious intrinsic haram copying of another religion. So obviously in the haircutting part we would have spoken about مَنْ تَشَبَّهَ بِقَوْمٍ فَهُوَ مِنْهُمْ. Whoever imitates a people, then he's from them. And an imitation here would be wearing the dog collar of the priest, be wearing the monk thingy with the rope, whatever. And the irony, of course, is that theirs, or is it our, is it Shazad's Maghribi thob collection, right? Because he's obsessed with that kind of, you know, that hooded thing. But that's basically what a monk wears, isn't it? It's exactly the same material, the same hood, looks like the KKK kind of thing. Again, right up Shazad Salim Street, yeah? So, you know, who was there first? Was it Shazad first? Was it the KKK first? Or was it the monks first? I don't know, but Shazad copies all of them anyway. So the point is that if we cannot see an obvious claim, I don't think that is a serious matter. If there is an obvious claim, then I don't think there's a discussion. I think it's pretty straightforward and obvious. All right. Sheikh says that it's also good to yartadi. Yartadi means to wear a rida. Remember that the basic principle of Arab clothes, even that's a bit of a silly statement. Maybe it is, I don't know. Or certainly Islamic clothing, is that there are two pieces, the upper piece and the lower piece. You've got to understand, yeah, I know, you know, we've spoken about this before, that when you speak about clothing, when you speak about anything, you've got to take yourself back to that context. So lack of money, lack of cloth, lack of cotton, lack of wool, and we just don't have the production and we don't have lots of availability, so cloth has multiple uses. And obviously, the more stitching, when I say stitching, I mean the more fitted something is, the less use it has, right? You put, you know, you throw a shalwar on the floor to eat on, you'd be like, where am I gonna put these arms? You're gonna fold it in, aren't you, right? And if you throw a shawl on the floor, well, that isn't a cloth, isn't it? The dastarkhan is a shawl. The dastarkhan, you fold it up, put it around your shoulders, is a full cloth. Anything that doesn't have a fitted shape to it is gonna be multiple use. That's how you can use it as a shroud. That's how people were shrouded in their normal clothes. So, you know, people don't understand that. They say, how were they shrouded in their clothes? Because their clothes don't have sleeves. It's a shawl, which you're wrapping yourself in, right? And there is nothing underneath. People don't get that part either. Likewise, underwear, that's a modern concept, the concept of having another layer underneath. It's always open. It's sarong style, lungi style, you know, Maui style, all of the different kind of nations, the Somalis, the Bengalis, the Malaysians, they have a different take on it, different tightening on it, the sarong, the English version or Western version. But ultimately, it's all a reflection of the fact that we don't have underwear or boxers or X or Y, whatever that form is. That's a huge extravagance. Not just the secondary cloth, but then shaping it, stitching it, all the rest of it. So there's always two pieces of cloth, bottom and top, right? And then anything that you have extra is seen as like, you know, levels. It's like this is Jum'ah, or this is a king, or this is a wedding. So a headgear, a cloak, you know, and long. Now you start to understand why the ahadith prohibit the dragging, because a person is intentionally showing that I've got so much wealth that I don't need to have my thing cut off at the knee to save on cloth,
You get what I'm saying? I can afford to have it all the way to my feet. You get my point? So they would drag their robes, right? And that's why, like, I'm of the opinion that there is no prohibition in Isbal of like this trousers, because the longer the trouser that a person wears, you don't think that, oh my God, man, that guy is, mashallah, he's made it in life with those 2 extra inches. You wouldn't say that. But today, if you're in the masjid and a guy like one of these kind of secular type Saudis walk past and you can see that the thobe is trailing behind him, he's immediately making an intentional step. Unlike the packer who's doing that, who we know he just opened the packet, yeah? He's got the wrong size. You can spot him a mile off. This is a pack, he's a tourist, he's just gone into the shop, he's bought his duffel thobe, it's 2 sizes too big, he's dragging it along, miskin, he just looks like a complete yanibachara. Whereas a Saudi is perfectly fitted there, perfect whatever, and dragging alongside, he wants to show that I am of an elite class. This is the kibar of Isbal. That's my position. It's the position held by a minority of scholars, and others said that no, everything and anything which is below the ankle is in the hellfire, as the Prophet ﷺ said, because he did keep it open. Whatever is below the ankle is in the hellfire. And that's why they took that literally. Shazi, it feels like you desperately want to say something. Desperately. The izar. What? Izar, yeah, yeah.
How would they tie it back in the day? How would they use
it? I don't recall a hadith, according to my very limited knowledge, of anything that explains whether it's a towel tie, whether it was always with a belt, but we do know that some people did use a belt.
So my point is, they rode horses.
They what? Yeah.
And they didn't wear underwear, number one.
Yeah.
Number 2, they're gonna be on and off horses.
Yes. So how does that work?
Because this is, you know, you look at the...
We have to refer to the horse riders, bro.
Because the shalwar kameez is perfect, obviously.
It would. That's why we always said shalwar kameez is the sunnah Islam, it is, of clothing. The thobe is the most impractical, of course.
So the question is, how did they use the tie there?
By the way, the thobe is the most impractical clothes in human history, by the way. For anything. That's why they don't do any work. Yani, who are the most privileged people in the world? Let's not, Yani, get ourselves banned from every country in the world. But the point is that an Arab thobe, I mean, who's actually wearing one of those and serious about anything? Whether it's serious about work or labor or driving or labor, or no, it's not. Why? That's why all the Pakis are doing it in the shalwar kameez, isn't it? You wear shalwar kameez, you see a guy in shalwar kameez, you go, this guy, legit banda, he's here to work. Isn't it? He's got full movement. Wait, what are you going to do in the thobe, bro? That's why if you see a legit guy wearing a thobe, you know how he's wearing that thobe. He's wrapped it up and tucked it into his bottoms, isn't it? You see his shalwar underneath fully, and so he basically turned his thobe into one of our pocket kameezes, basically. You know what I'm saying? It is interesting, and it just goes to emphasize again that this idea of there being a sunnah clothing and a sunnah form of clothing, it's just not yani real life. It's just not real life. And that's like, and that goes back to the point that I said last week. The irony that I would wear a thobe to defend those people who would so ignorantly think that a thobe is the sunnah clothing. That the Prophet ﷺ, yani, being the action man that he was, legit action man. Like Shaz makes that point, right? About how do you wear a thobe. I'll tell you something actually, Shaz. It's very interesting actually, you make that point. In the hadith in Bukhari, in the hadith narrated by Anas ibn Malik radiallahu anhu, he said, famous hadith, he goes that there was one time we were asleep and we heard a huge, like, terrifying sound. And he woke everybody up. And basically we thought we were under attack, we're being bombarded, right? So everybody's grabbing clothes left, right, center, you know, because they're in a state of nakedness and they're trying to get themselves covered and out, because they can't even work out whether it's an earthquake so that the houses are falling down or whether the enemy's outside, so we've got to go out and deal with them, right? And Anas said that whilst in the complete madness and confusion, everyone's running this, that, whatever, whatnot, When we came outside, we saw the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam returning back from where the sound had come from, and he said, guys, it's all under control. It's nothing. And he described him. He goes, he was on my stepfather's horse, shirtless. On my stepfather's horse. Yani, the intimation was that, and what was trying to intimate, is that as soon as it happened, Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam literally just jumped out, grabbed the nearest horse, straight yani into the action. Realize it's nothing, coming back, guys, as you were, right? Now, if you think about that action move, what would the bottom have been? We know that it was the izar. How is that izar yani dressed to be able to get on a horse and not yani exposed? I don't know, no idea. But actually, it was very common for the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam to be shirtless at home. In fact, I can't put a very affirmative statement, but I would almost argue that the default position of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam chilling at home was shirtless. And whenever he has guests, a hadith of Aisha radiallahu anha, when she was late, you know that he was waiting for her, and then she comes late, where have you been? She goes, Wallahi ya Rasulullah, I heard someone reciting, you're not going to believe yani his recitation. So, the Prophet ﷺ obviously loves recitation, and he's really yani interested in wanting to hear. And she's like, you know, you got to go and check him out. So the hadith states, so he grabbed his shirt and he put it around his chest. So obviously he's got his awrah covered. So he grabbed his shirt and he went out and he went and met the reciter, and he was Salim, Mawla Abi Hudhayfa radiallahu anhu, who used to be the Imam of Masjid al-Quba. So, yeah, I don't know why we've gone that tangent, but the point is that there's two sheets, essentially. And that was the way of the people. Very simple, very basic, and the like. And when they go into ihram, it's just a natural extension, actually. Yeah, and it's also a sheet, the top sheet, the bottom, but much more simple, and ideally white, and so on. Yeah. Anyway, Sheikh says, that it's good to wear a rida. And Sheikh Uthaymeen says, the way that this author has put this statement, it's like as if he's saying that he puts a rida on, even if he's got a qamis on. Like as if rida is some religious addition to the game, even if you've got something on. And Sheikh says, you know, and وَهَذَا فِيهِ نَظَرٍ يعني, you know, I don't know about that. You know, so he's obviously not convinced in that argument. I don't think anybody's convinced in that argument. The whole point is having some kind of top. And if you've got a top on, there's no sunnah to put on another top. So now Sheikh Uthaymeen goes into a interesting tangent himself. He goes, as for us, so you're talking about Saudis, He goes, as for us then, we have the mishlah. Now the mishlah is a word that is a pure Arabic word. I haven't heard it for years, by the way. In fact, you only hear it actually said by scholars in these books. You guys would know the mishlah as the bisht, which is a word that none of you also would never have known until Messi and Bajara. Yani, you know, he was, I didn't know what the verb is. He was bakrad, yani, you know, on behalf of the Qatari family, or he was Jamesed, Bachara James. James, so aren't you changing your name? Bachara was like, what's wrong with James? My God, yo, Sheikh Abdul Ghaffar is legit. He goes to him, did anybody force you? The guy goes, no, I don't think so. Ashadu. You want to keep your name? I think you can take a new name. And he goes, no, I think James is all right. Bachara, whoa, this guy is the worst shahada I've ever seen in my life, bro. Oh my God. He's such a nice guy, has so much energy, so nice. Guy's been traumatized for the rest of his life. Now he's gonna go home sleeping. What the hell's wrong with James? skin. Anyway, so that bisht. I think we have one here. Hippa, was it you who said to me the other day? They have one here behind. Hippa was saying that when she came with the school, they, who puts it on, Hippa?
the khatib thing. Yeah? So they give it to the kids to... So, I mean, no, I'm saying they offer it to the kids in a school visit. So they offered it to all of your classmates, basically, yeah? See, it's interesting that, I mean, obviously, it's for kids to show them a mosque and they give them some biscuits and tea and this is where the guy prays and this is where the imam is and this is... And so that part of the mosque visit is that this is what the imam wears when he's giving the khutbah, and they have the bisht there and they put it on. And if you're wondering what I mean by the bisht, if you didn't know what messy miskin wore, I'm talking about that brocade type, lace type, see-through type kind of cloak that goes on. It's normally gold with a golden thing, brocade, what do you call that, trim, or is black with a gold trim. That's what we're talking about. So it's almost, and now, anyway, let me tell you what Sheikh Uthaymeen says. He goes, the majority of the people today, they don't wear this anymore, right? And if a person actually was to wear it in front of the people, they would like cuss him. Yeah, and if a normal folk would wear, and he's right, in Saudi, if a normal guy, you know, walking down the street wearing that, they'd cuss him. Whereas back in the day, if you didn't wear that, you get cussed. It's like part and parcel of putting yourself as a real man, right? So he's talking about just in his lifetime, 20, 30 years ago, the cultural shift that he saw, that the people all used to wear it, versus now nobody wearing it. And now it's almost like, and it has zero religious significance, but of course, when you see that, what do you immediately think? Is a scholar, is the imam, this is the whatever. And when it comes to like videos that are showing, there's not many actually, we made our own. The Hajj Bidayee team made a really good one actually, which at the moment they're all in Hajj mode, but maybe after the Hajj thing calms down, they'll release it. The fiqh and the understanding of the rain, the rain prayer, yeah, rain prayer. And it's a shame that when they're trying to explain what should happen, the maximum they can show is the imam changing his bisht, because it's an easy, open garment, you know, on top to just take out and just inverse. You can't tell anyway, it all looks the same, yeah? So, and everyone's understanding of how, what actually happens in a rain prayer is revolving around the videos that they've seen of the imam finishing the khutbah, taking his bisht off, turning it inside out, and put it back on again. Because, you know, but actually, of course, the Prophet ﷺ never had that. And that's why this discussion, and you'll see me in the video, and I'm wearing a thobe, and I turn it the way that one of the narrations is. That's actually what would have happened. And even that is doubtful, because the Prophet ﷺ very rarely had fitted clothing. So it would be literally, you take off the sheet, turn it inside out, and wrap yourself back up with it again, kind of situation, right? Anyway, so he then says, yeah, let's see if there's any points. In regards to the belt, if it gets any impurities on it, will it affect the validity of the salah, whether it be an ihram belt or a leather belt? Yes, it would, because that's obviously being worn on your body. Yeah.
I want to ask about the turban. So the turban obviously has significance to the seats, for example.
Yeah.
In the way that they
are. Is it only significant for the Sikhs in the way that it's worn?
There's a certain way that Sikhs would wear a turban, you can see distinguishes that.
Yeah. Sure. There's a certain kind of shape that you know is a Sikh one, yeah.
You mean
is it that if you were to copy that, that would be considered impermissible because that's the default for them? Sure. I mean, look, I think that when it comes to understanding, for example, the imama, I think it would require more confirmation, for example, that the Sikhs and their shape is a religious aspect as opposed to a cultural one. So what might be the religious part is the covering of their hair. I'm not big on my Sikh kind of theology, but let's just assume that the obligation for them is the covering of their hair, but the way that it's done is different. And I do think it's that, because how many Yani Sikhs, I mean, I grew up with a lot of Sikhs. Correct, you got the other one. Yeah, exactly, bandana type. And although I do get the feeling that there is a kind of a tier level that once you get to that level, you're legit Sikh kind of thing, versus Yani. Yeah, Legitinder Singh and Illegitinder Singh. That was in my head, I was like, I can't say that. But it's there now, it's done. Alhamdulillah, that's out of my system. I knew so many Jitinder Singhs. It was waiting for a Legitinder Singh, isn't it? Come on. Come on, Kam, give me that one at least. Yes, Omar.
You know how you mentioned about people from unnamed countries wearing clothes going quite long?
Mm.
So when I was there, I noticed that a lot of people, they had the third long, but they wouldn't actually like drag on the floor.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam actually was very specific about the different lengths of, and the word is never thawb, right? The word is izar, the lower garment. And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said ankle, and then above the ankle, and then halfway up the calf, which is a saq, yani basically halfway. So that's what the Prophet ﷺ has indicated. And there are other lesser hadith which indicate that a person's kind of like reward or taqwa is the more higher it is. Now this is another interesting point, because we said that if clothing which you're wearing to intentionally show off or intentionally put other people down is impermissible, and that's of course yani the kibr, which is in the heart. The alternative existed very strongly 10, 20 years ago, and lesser now, and it goes in cycles, where you've got the religious crew that exaggerate in their clothing to indicate that they are better than the rest of the people, and it often would be in their thobes, where they would walk around actually technically in line with the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, which states that the best is halfway. But when you see that person, they look weird, right? They look like, it just looks weird. And their argument is, this is the sunnah, brother. Here's the hadith aki, right? And they're right, technically, except that the Prophet ﷺ never wore that in a thobe, right? And the irony is, like, think of your standard Malaysian, or even Bengali, or even Somali. Their lungis are not down to the bottom, they're halfway. And when you look at a Bengali with a long shirt, or even not a long shirt, short shirt, and the lungi at halfway, it looks completely normal. He does not stick out. But if a guy wears a thob up to his, he sticks out a mile. And that just shows the ignorance of people who try to take hadith that have context and apply it upon the whole world according to their own opinion. You know what I'm saying? So, I do think we need to be careful with the thawb, because I do believe that the thawb is the hadith of Isbal, or the prohibition of anything below the ankles, applies to thawbs, even though that was not the standard code of dress back in the day, because the thawb, from an analogy point of view, is as close to an izar as it gets, meaning it's a single opening. So for me, anything which is single opening drape, so like the abaya type, thawb, whatever, then this is impermissible to have below the ankles. And this is the safest position. Obviously, this is males. For the female, it's the exact opposite, subhanAllah. For the female, it's the exact opposite. The shorter, yani the trouble that she's in, aura, this, that, reputation, blah, blah, blah. And that used to be pre-Islam as well. And then the longer that it is, it used to be more respectable pre-Islam, and in Islam, it's even more emphasized. And so emphasized and so rewarded
that even there are hadith to take the waswas out of your head. Because you would have doubt about that. How can yani, dragging cloth be any good when all the streets are dirty and everything, whatever? And the Prophet ﷺ said that with the first step that it gets dirty, the second step cleans it. So get the waswas out of your head. Yani, when you're looking at a woman with her dragging parts all dusty, the last thing you need to be thinking about, and certainly the last thing that she needs to be thinking about, is that I've got najas on my dress. Yes. Yeah. Yes. You're saying that, yeah, it's better for women to have longer dress, blah, 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 but what about in a wedding scenario where it's not being used as a modest game, it's being used in a thingy? Yeah, you gotta give her a day at least, yeah, come on. You're hardcore, bro. You're not even gonna give her a wedding day? She's gotta look good on a wedding day, bro. I mean, to us, it looks the whole bloody stupid, isn't it? Woman, you know, 26 meters of cloth and five people trying to carry it. But if she likes it, then good luck to her, man. She's only wearing it that day. She's never wearing it again. I don't know, bro. I don't know. In following the customs of the people, if, for example, you're in Canada, would it be more rewarding for you to wear a dress shirt and pants, obviously long and loose, instead of wearing an abaya to work or to uni? And I think this is an excellent question, right? And I think it's a tough question, because there's absolutely no doubt that if you think of a practicing woman now, like a proper practicing woman, that's wearing a heavily baggy top and a heavy baggy bottoms that don't, like as per sunnah, as per what you're meant to, they don't show the outline of the limbs and of the legs. So it's like those trouser skirts as opposed to whatever. And you've got that same lady in a abaya, right? Which one is closer, or which one is more rewarded, or whatever? And it's a subjective, acceptable Islamic discussion. And I struggle to say that the abaya is more rewarded, unless we have heavy caveats. So I would say, for example, if she's a very strong character, strong whatever, doing it to yani, protect the Muslim minority, blah, 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 bring attention to folks, like I used to back in the day, then I think she gets more reward for wearing the abaya. Yeah? I think if she's in an environment where that's not a problem, but there is a particular issue where there's a lot of tension and we need to normalize things and the people are very sensitive at the moment yani, to an abaya, there might have been a terrorist attack where they had worn abayas, for example. Yeah? Or worse, men disguised as abayas and now people are really kind of ignited and inflamed, then I think the other might be a good example. So just calm the rhetoric and let's get into that normal Western clothes and make it realize that, listen, this is not some kind of, cut me and I bleed abaya, but I'm a Muslim with principles in our clothing. I don't have a uniform. So I do believe it's intention-based, and I would also be happy to support a scholar that would say, no, absolutely the baggy clothes is the rewarded one because this is the clothes of the people and this is what will help her be normalized. And I like that argument. Except, of course, that it will always be flawed because the hijab can never change to anything that is Canadian, right? The hijab cannot be turned into anything else other than what it is. And so that's why it is important that when you're having this discussion of trying to be kind of culturally sound in your community or your custom, that it's not based upon fear, right? Because there's two people that will make the argument to wear the same clothing and you'd think that's great, and it's not great. There's one woman who did it because she just doesn't have the guts. Yeah, and so she just wears baggy clothing, yeah, because she just cannot make that switch. And women are like that, by the way. When they start practicing, it's a bit by a bit kind of game, right? It's not hijab, then to hijab, and that hijab is a very tight, kind of not great hijab, then it turns into a proper Islamic hijab, then and the clothes are still tight, then the clothes become baggier, and then the clothes go to an abaya. And then, you know, it's there, and then niqab is between these two, but these are the top tier kind of women, right? And so Let's say that you get to, like, someone who's there, thereabouts, getting there, but they can't do it, and they're scared, and so they wear that. That's not the same as a woman who believes, no, I need to wear this clothing, that's the sunnah. I could wear an abaya for fun, actually. No problem at all, I've worn it all my life. But I'm gonna wear that to set a few statements, to make a few points. And of course, the obligations need to be maintained. So when she's in public, when she's praying, when she's moving, the clothes choice that she chose does not expose her outline and her body more than an abaya. Then there's no discussion, of course. It has to be a direct replacement for what the abaya is doing in terms of covering awrah, right? So I do believe, as I said, that there are some nuances in that. Right. With that being said, then وَيُبَكِّرَ إِلَيْهَا. So it is a sunnah, Sheikh Uthaymeen says, to be early to the Jum'ah. The hadith in play that establishes this is the big hadith, the hadith of Abu Hurairah radiallahu ta'ala anhu, من اغتسل يوم الجمعة ثم راح في الساعة الأولى فكأنما قرب بدنه ومن راح في الساعة الثانية فكأنما قرب بقرة ومن راح في الساعة الثالثة فكأنما قرب كبشا أقرا ومن راح في الساعة الرابعة فكأنما قرب دجاجة ومن راح في الساعة الخامسة فكأنما قرب بيضة. And that's why Shahzad Salim loves eggs. And his collection of eggs is mashallah tabarak al-Rahman. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said that whoever takes ghusl on the day of Jum'ah and then leaves in the first hour, then it's like he slaughtered a camel. And whoever leaves for Jum'ah in the second hour, then it is like he slaughtered a cow. I mean, current rates, you're looking at $3,000 odd, if I'm not wrong, for a camel. Imagine that you said, I'm going to do an act of charity. Yeah? Now, $3,000 is a big move, right? And a cow is probably I don't know. What are we saying for a cow these days? Huh? Two. A sheep at the moment is what, $2,250? Yeah? Yeah, so then maybe a couple of grand. Then yeah, maybe $1,500, $2,000 for a cow. Camel might be more than actually $3,000, $3,500 possibly. So just to give you some context about what it means to sacrifice a, you know, that's big. And also think about how many people it feeds as well. So we're talking big actions, yeah? So whoever leaves in the second hour, then it's as if they slaughtered a cow. And whoever leaves in the third hour, then it's like the one who slaughtered a ram, horned ram, you know, value, is a breeder. It's a stud, yeah? And whoever goes in the fourth hour, then it's like the one who slaughtered a chicken. And whoever then leaves in the fifth hour, then it's like the one who put forward an egg. And that's why Shahzad's selection and collection of eggs is mashallah. Whose collection of eggs is more, Shaz? Shaz, why are you trying to be holy for? I know you want to throw me under the bus. I have a fantastic collection of eggs. That's what Shahzad wants to say. All right. Why did you get personal for, Shaz? What are you going to get personal for? I didn't get personal, did I? What are you going to say? Astaghfirullah. So, wahada, and Sheikh says that, so there's no doubt that to be early is the best thing that you can do. But of course, to be early is obviously after having a shower and perfuming and cleaning yourself properly, which is ironic because the idea of cleaning and all the like of it was because you're coming from work. At the same time, the only way that you're hitting the top mark is obviously not working. Yeah, you know, if you're going in the first hour, and then yeah, and wearing best clothes, etc. as well. To do all of those things, you're going to have to be at home. And so how many people today go to Jum'ah? They have to come from work. So they clearly are not at top elite level, right? By the way, also the hadith, this hadith has always been differed over, that what does it mean? What does the first hour mean? Because it is that's exactly what it says, the first hour, right? And the scholars, what they all agreed on is that it refers to the division of the time, so divided into basically five equal parts. Some said six, because they took it literally, right? And each one is then called an hour. And that's acceptable because in the Arabic, sa'a, although it means hour, it also means time, right? It's like a general word. So it can apply to like a period of time, more than an hour. And so in today, yeah. So that's what they agree on. So it's portions. So the first portion, second portion, third portion. That's how you should understand the hadith. And Allah knows best. The second important question is that when's it starting from? Does it start at Fajr, which is what a number of scholars, the Hanbalis and the Shafi'is hold, which starts at Fajr time, and Fajr meaning the second dawn, meaning the true dawn? Or is it as Abu Hanifa said, which is sunrise? And we feel that that's the correct position. That's the class position as well. And it's a growing position when you think about it, because it fits with other ahadith. And that's important. You should never take a hadith in isolation. How can we praise a person that goes to the masjid early for Jum'ah, knowing that he has to go home to do ghusl and X, Y, Z, when he's being told by the Prophet ﷺ to be in the masjid until sunrise? You get what I'm saying? That's a hadith which is in play, isn't it? To be there in the masjid, remain in a state of dhikr until yani the sun rises, pray to raka'ah, Hajj and Umrah reward. Then you got to go home, and then you got to have some time, isn't it? To get changed, blah, blah, blah. And also, yeah, so I think that this is logical, it's practical, it fits the yani, thing. So now, what would that be in today's winter? So if we're talking Manchester right now, sunrise is about 8. Alright, so sunrise is 8, Dhuhr starts at 12:30, yeah? So what's that? 4.5 hours divided by 6 is like 45 minutes odd or something? Ish? So, 45 minutes? And if you divide it by 5, then it's like about 55 minutes or 52 minutes. So, if we are looking at Jum'ah, the first one here, for example, is at 12:35. Yeah? Imagine. Basically, it's an egg fest. Yeah, and if you are arriving at 11:45, you're basically getting an egg. Even though no one would be here. That's even more worse. Yeah. By the way, the uncles come early, mashallah. Mashallah. And so if you want at least a chicken, and you got to put forward a chicken at least, you know what I'm saying? You need to be basically coming here for 11:30. That's no joke, bro. You know what I'm saying? No joke. I don't think I've ever got anything beyond a chicken in my entire life, by the way. Chicken. I know I've got a chicken before. I've got a chicken before. Listen, I'm not that bloody bagharati. I never had a chicken before. So I'm going to say that in Mecca, I'm on an egg diet all the time. I'm a food court, hotel kind of entrance. Not even the egg white. You know what they do? You see these people who eat eggs and they leave the whites. You know, I'm not even getting the egg whites. You know, we was there in December, and my theory is always to leave late, right? Because when you leave late, then they've normally closed off a lot of kind of roads and stuff, and you get an easy route to where you want to pray. And if you're willing to pray in the sun, which I always am, by the way, always happy to pray in the sun, then you'll get into the courtyard. Because I know that there's no chance that I go at 9 o'clock like everyone does when they go for 9 o'clock to get in. There's no way I can stay awake. No way. I'm asleep within 20 minutes. And there's no way that I'm doing, of all lessons to not be here, Islam chooses this one to not be here. Islam Omani, let's just make this public, is the only guy that I've seen that inside where he's actually sitting in the masjid, he makes wudu. Okay? Except that Islam Omani was like, you know, when he saw some paki do it, he goes, let me raise you 1 billion. And he did it in the roda on the carpet. bro, where is he, man? He's normally right there in my target sights. He's not here. He's not well. Damn right he's not well. In the head. I was so shocked when he said that to me, I remember. And I was like in the order with him when he told me. I go, what? I couldn't believe it. And he goes to me, you taught us. I go, I didn't teach you in the Roda. This much water. No. He used this much water. There's no doubt about that. He's very good at that. MashaAllah. But I didn't tell him to do it in the Roda on the carpet. Green holy carpet. Security, they must have been looking at that guy. They step back. The guy, they go, guys, pagali is. So, nah, that's too much, man. They're Mujahideen, those people who go that time. Anyway, the story, so normally I'm staying at these hotels, Jabal Umar, this, that, blah, blah, blah. Whereas it's a piece of cake. You go out at that time and then you go straight into the courtyard. And if you can't deal with that, then you go to the extension. So I'm at 12 o'clock at Lever. The big rookie mistake is that in December we were upgraded to this new hotel called Jumeirah. It's like this big brand hotel. When we came out, they'd closed the road off because it's a bit further down, past the Conrad, past the whatever. They'd closed the road off, so we were trapped. I go, there's no way I'm praying Jumu'ah here. So I pulled a sick move. I went back into the hotel, and I went via the coaches. You know, at the back of the hotel, I went straight through the lobby, straight out the coaches, and that's obviously completely empty. So I walked all the way down, and I came in through the Hilton Suites entrance. You know, up there, through the elevator, straight out, yani straight out Jabal Umar. MashaAllah, absolutely empty. Walk straight into the courtyard, right to the front. Buzzing. A little bit of heat, it's all right. And a dead khutbahs, you need a little bit of heat from the sun. You're not going to give me so much trouble, man. Anyway, Irfan was there as well. Irfan, yeah, was saying, bro, that was a madness. Right, okay. So it's good to go early. What else do we want to talk about going early? Yeah, I think that's it. You've got to put it into context. The only people who go to the haram early and the amount of difficulty they go through. There's no doubt that they'll inshallah get the reward, but it's very different. Yeah? It's very different. And to be honest, yani, obviously I can say this in this gathering because people understand. But it's very difficult that when you're with a new group of people, especially because you know that the tarbiyah program for Umrah and Hajj is obviously very important because it's where we eventually get most of our students. So they're always at the beginning stage. And I don't want to crush dreams of people who are saying, Sheikh, what time are we going tomorrow morning? I'm saying, yeah, you're going at 9 o'clock. Because if I say anything else, they're like, what kind of kafir is this? Kafir munafiq, yani telling me to go at 12 o'clock. Yani, I came yani, all the way. What kind of mulvi are you? You're telling us to go at 12. He wants me to say 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. I'm not going to destroy his dreams. I'm going to say, you go at 9 o'clock, mate. Yeah? Because for him, the most important thing of his life is I pray Jumu'ah in the Haram. And I'm the guy who goes out at 12 o'clock, catches a taxi to go to Rajahi Masjid. We did it in this one as well. I always pray Rajahi. I don't like praying in the Haram. Right? Jumu'ah, I mean. For my guy and the Takfiriya. But, yani, Jumu'ah. Huh? No. What are you going to get personal for? What are you going to get personal for? The all-time classic was, not this one, I think people are used to it now, but a couple of programs ago, I went up to the taxi drivers. Obviously, all the taxi drivers are dropping people off, doing anything to get to the Haram. And I sat in a car, he goes, where are you going? I go, I want to go to Rajahi Masjid. He goes, are you sure? You mean after Salah now? I go, now for Jumu'ah, you packing, hurry up. He goes, oh, all right then. He was bamboozled. But it's about what you want to hear. If you're listening to a khutbah and all you're thinking is that when you die, you detest the guy, you shouldn't yani, put yourself in a scenario where you're led by a person that you're making lanat against. You know? So, nah. I'm alright with that. But the point is that the Jumu'ah prayer is not the most important prayer that a Muslim will pray in the Haram. The most important prayer that a Musafir Haji Mu'tamir will pray will be the Friday morning in Jama'ah. That will be the most important prayer. The most obligatory prayer that he will pray is the Jumu'ah prayer, but he doesn't need to pray that in the Haram. But if he prays it in the Haram, great, he gets fantastic, massive reward. And if it has a culturally, emotionally massive impact upon him, then I think it's a very important prayer for him. Far more important for me to pray the Asr prayer, to pray the Maghrib prayer, to pray the Fajr prayer. But the Jumu'ah prayer for me is something which is obligated upon the Muslims in their locality. I'm not obligated to pray that in the Haram. If I was there at the time of the Adhan, astaghfirullah, that's not permissible. But if you leave before the Adhan to go to a different area, that's the same as like me coming out of Chido and going to Longside. And is it haram to pray my Jum'ah in Makki? Of course not. That's the same. But obviously people will be like, how on earth did you leave the Haram for that? Very easily, we've spoken about that before, that quality of prayer is better than the quantity of the prayer. But anyway, yeah. No, I think that, so Fahad, if for the sake of the microphone, he's like, you know, how would that make sense to go to the masjid early and pray when our ibadah, the focus is on private? You're right, the focus is on private, except when it's time to be public. Because the other argument can be made as well, that in Islam there's so much focus on the public. We have obligated the obligatory prayer. So there's just that perfect balance, that there will be times where you gotta go hardcore public and not just obligations, like Taraweeh, right? Which is not obligatory. But you're right, the majority of the time it is private. But this is one of those unique times in which you're actually being told to come. And the Prophet ﷺ said, and he prays that which Allah has written for him. Meaning that if a person comes 1-2 hours and he's praying for 1-2 hours, those sunnah units that he's praying are not part of the units of Jumu'ah. They are the part of the units of a person getting ready for Jumu'ah and praying that which Allah has written for him. And that's yani a massive reward. And I want to say something as well, actually. And I don't know why. Yeah. No, that's not it. I wanted to say something and... Oh, where is that not... I would have thought that... 1 second, folks. Oh, here we are. It's like, what's happened? Where's the hadith gone? Right. I want to tell you guys about this hadith. Because there are different narrations of this hadith. The Prophet ﷺ said, "Man ghassala wa ghtasal." Many of you will have heard about this. "Man ghassala wa ghtasal. Wa bakkara wa btakar. Wa masha wa lam yarkab. ودنا من الإمام فاستمع ولم يلغ ولم يلغ يعني كان له بكل خطوة يخطها أجر سنة عمل صيامها وقيامها كما قال صلى الله عليه وسلم whoever غسل واغتسل. Let me translate it all and then we come back to it. Whoever washes and washes, just keep it at that for now, and goes early, and walked and didn't ride, didn't take a lift, and got close to the imam and listened intently, and didn't yani indulge in any vain or gossip or pointless talk, for every single step that he took, he will receive the reward of 1 year of fasting and praying. This hadith is one of the most famous ahadith in the Sunnah. For what reason? Nope. I'll say it again. Whoever غسل واغتسل وبكر وابتكر ودنا ومشى ولم يركب ودنا من الإمام. يعني whoever washed and washed, whoever came early and early, whoever walked and didn't take a ride, whoever got close to the Imam and listened very carefully, yeah, and didn't indulge in any vain speech, for every step he takes or took, he gets the reward of a year of fasting and standing. Why is this famous hadith or the one or the single? Correct, Shams, yeah. It is the single hadith that we know in the Sunnah that has the biggest reward possible to be described. Because it's not possible, it's ridiculous actually. Try to quantify it. Like a normal person here in Cheadle, right? Let's not use an extreme example, but it's got to be 5,000 steps, right? Most people are not that close. So if you take 5,000 steps, which is not that far, right? That's 5,000 years of praying every single day and fasting every single day for what? For walking to the masjid. You understand? And this is why this hadith came under the living amount of scrutiny. Why? Is a...
Well, not a hadith which have high level rewards, they usually act suspicious.
Correct. Correct. In the principle and sciences of hadith, there's clues. You follow a checklist. So if you know nothing about hadith, and you're hearing a hadith for the first time, your radar should start going when you see a few things. One of them is when extreme levels of reward are mentioned. Others when big numbers are mentioned. Others when names are mentioned. Others when geographic locations are specified. What else? In this ilk, right? And so this is like right in red territory. And what's amazing is that this hadith, with all of the critical analysis that was brought upon it, the vast majority of scholars consider it to be authentic from its chain. And you would not believe how much they tried to make it weak, because it just doesn't fit anything of any level of balance of reward. It doesn't. And that's the beauty of hadith sciences, that they take the right methodology and they don't make it weak because I just can't accept this. It just doesn't make sense. But I know it doesn't make sense, but I'm only going to reject it if the evidence suggests it. And I'm going to go through the chain, and they go through the chain, and my God, do they go through the chain. And they can't find a weakness, and they say, that's it, I've got the problem. Why wouldn't it be? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is trying to promote this act. Why wouldn't? That happens in every society. A crazy amount of reward from time to time in order to, to give benefits to people, because we need that to happen. Every society does it. So why wouldn't it be in our religion as well? This hadith is narrated by Imam Abu Dawood and narrated by Imam Ahmad, and its chain is full of trustworthy narrators, narrated by Imam Nasa'i as well. It's narrated by Imam Abdul Razak in his Musannaf, it's narrated by Ibn Abi Shayba in his Musannaf, it's narrated by Imam Al-Marwazi as well, it's narrated in the Sahih of Ibn Khuzayma, it is narrated by Imam Al-Tahawi as well. This hadith is, no joke, narrated by Imam Al-Tabarani in his Al-Kabir, it's narrated by Imam Al-Hakim, narrated by Imam Al-Bayhaqi as well. Narrated by Imam al-Baghwi fi Sharh al-Sunnah. And it was considered to be authentic by Ibn Khuzayma, by Ibn Hibban, by Imam al-Hakim. It was considered to be sound, hasan, by Imam al-Tirmidhi. Shaykh al-Albani considered this hadith to be authentic. I think this hadith is authentic. But it's just interesting because, as I said, that people don't actually realize how important it is. Now, there are a number of variations of this hadith as well, and they are a bit weak, all right? But, anyway, so to come early is a blessing. Let's just finish off this hadith. So Bilal has posted an English translation. So let's talk about this, yeah? And then we end. Man ghassala wa ghtasal, right? So The scholars differed on what this hadith actually means because two similar words are being used each time. وَبَكَّرَ وَابْتَكَرَ. And you could be lazy and say whoever washes and washes and whoever goes early and goes early, right? Because that's what's being indicated. Whereas some scholars said that no, what it means is that the second time the word is mentioned is as an emphasis for the first. So مَنْ غَسَّلَ وَاغْتَسَلَ means whoever washes, yeah, washes, and whoever goes early, yes, early. You know, like an emphasizing kind of thing. So that's also a weak argument as well. So repetition, weak argument. That is emphasizing, weak argument. That they're different in meaning is clearly a strong argument, but then what are we gonna then give as a meaning? So many scholars, as you all know, translated مَنْ غَسَّلَ وَاغْتَسَلَ. The first one means that whoever causes another person to have a bath, meaning marital relations, therefore obligating upon another person that didn't need to have a bath, meaning your wife, for example, now she has to make a ghusl for janaba. So whoever causes another person to have a bath, مَنْ غَسَّلَ, and the word غَسَّلَ comes from فَعَلَ, which is a verb which is normally another person, yeah? Like when we say كَلَّمَ, that means he spoke to him. You know what I'm trying to say? You're involving another person. So, man ghassala here is the one who caused the other one to have a bath and then bathed themselves. Wabakkara wabtakar. This was a difficult one. So they said that whoever goes early and catches the very beginning of the khutbah. I like this, actually. I never used to when I was younger, but I like it now. Because when you're younger, you never consider a toilet in the game. When you get older, yani, and your bladder is not as strong, this hadith can make sense. Because you could go early, yeah, and then be in a toilet when at the key moment, everything happens. You got what I'm saying? Now, and that's not as great as a person who goes early and keeps their concentration up and everything under control and is there at the beginning of the khutbah. In fact, so many scholars said wabtakar means that they're at the beginning of the khutbah, which has some qiyas with a hadith that we know that a person who is there at the takbiratul ihram. The takbiratul ihram was a sign. You know, the salaf, they used to consider the level of a Muslim by the how many takbiratul ihrams does he catch versus whoever's, you know, always that person when you turn around and, you know, after salah's finished and he's standing up because he came late. You know, you have that. You know, amongst the men, we know who those people are. They get reputation, right? You know whose reputation mostly those people are? Those people who live close to the masjid. It's the disease of living close to the masjid. It's the fitna of living close to the masjid. You always leave late. And the blessing of being far away is that you are always afraid that you're going to be late, so you come earlier. It's a blessing. All my life I've seen that in my own life, other people's lives. Everyone knows that anecdotally. So anyway, so that's the meaning. So how did this guy translate it? I don't know who the translation is from, Bilal. Tell us who it's from. Whoever performs ghusl on Friday and bathes completely. So they didn't go with that. Yeah? So whoever does it, whoever does ghusl technically, but then does it also properly, like a lot, proper cleaning, which is an acceptable interpretation, by the way. Scholars said that. And goes early and arrives early. That's not a bad meaning as well. So he left early and also got early. Didn't dilly-dally along the way. Didn't go somewhere else, for example, cheeky little coffee and then, you know what I mean? Right? Gets close and listens and is silent. There will be for him in every step he takes the reward of a year of fasting and standing in prayer. Suraya is saying, does that apply to women too? Yes, it applies to anybody that is going for the Jum'ah prayer and putting themselves through the effort. Because it is a lot of hard work, actually. It's not that simple. Yeah. مَنْ غَسَّلَ وَاغْتَسَلَ. I have, yeah? Could be. No, listen, there's got to be at least 15, 20 different opinions on this from the big imams, not like from us lot, like, you know, from the big imams. So there's no consensus on this. And Allah knows best. All right, I think we'll call it there and we'll take some questions. Any here? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Oh no. So I'm not talking about the validity of the people's prayer. 100%. Yeah. And whenever police or authorities push you into a location, that is the Jum'ah prayer, 100%. What is not acceptable is a person who starts off there, like shopkeepers, right? And they just set up their stall outside and they just sit down with massive gaps in front of them. They're relying on the fact that the road is going to get closed and then the lines are going to come up to them and they were like, hey, what's wrong with this? You know what I'm saying? And he's right. His prayer is a valid prayer and he's part of the Jama'ah and he's continued the stuff, but it's not a great intention. But it's okay. And yeah, obviously nowadays people are just obsessed with the prayer rooms. But we spoke about that in the lines and stuff like that. Regarding the reward mentioned in this hadith, if someone has the opportunity to walk to a close by masjid and fulfill these conditions or travel by a car to lead the khutbah at a masjid further away, what should they prefer? There's no doubt walking, we're covering that next week. But obviously it's different when a person is the imam, that's something else. If you're leading the khutbah, you're doing that yani for a reason. So that's a thing. What's your opinion on the reading of Surah Al-Baqarah either every day or every 3 days for blessings? Seems to be something that is being talked about a lot recently. Is it? No, nothing specific with Surah Al-Baqarah in a number of days. Something that should be recited every day, definitely, because it blesses the house and protects the house. But it shouldn't be seen that it has to be every day, it has to be completed, or it has to be every 3 days. There's no hadith for that. There's no evidence for that. Question? No. Questions, folks? Anything else? Yeah, I'm not. No, I don't think driving counts, but we're going to cover it next week. There's, again, caveats to it. There's caveats to it. Announcements. What announcements do we have? Obviously, those that are going to Hajj, this is crunch week, so you should go to the website. Aqsa. It's going to happen, inshallah. But people need to know that it's now a visa-based system. Everybody, whatever your passport, you have to go online just like Saudi and apply for a tourist visa basically. $7 and it's instant or it takes time. So that's a consideration. And that's only to go to the border. What do you mean? Do you mean, is it guaranteed entry? Nothing. It's never guaranteed entry. Every visa is not guaranteed entry. You can always be turned back. Absolutely no doubt about that. But the point is that you can't even make the flight without this visa. They'll check it at the airport. Departure airport. Aqsa, inshallah, late June. I want to say around 20 something, for those that want to just kind of keep those dates. And then end of September, possibly. What else? Protect This House closes next week. Two more webinars. We did two last week. One about kids and one about parents. And I think the parents one is an important one because everyone watches everything about kids, but I don't know if anybody does anything about parents. I think it's important. You'll find it on Al Maghrib YouTube channel. Next week, I'm going to be with Omar Suleiman on a issue that I think is very important, which is this rise of the activist kid. And I'm not very happy about that scenario, so I want to speak about that. And then with Taymiyyah Zubair on the Quran and kids. So that's going to be the two sessions. Obviously, if you've got Protect This House online already, which many of you obviously will have had from the first time it came out, then you don't need to be going and signing up again. These are all webinars you attend, and it's in your folder, etc. Omar. The Hajj one, yes. No. It's very specific only for Hajj people with thingies. If we try our best to be attentive to the khutbah, but because the khatib speaks in such a way, sometimes one dozes away, will the reward be affected? I mean, you'd have thought, innit? You know what I mean? But Allah is Ghafoor Rahim, All right. Barakallahu feekum. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta. Astaghfiruka Allahumma wa atubu ilayk. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.